Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. Okay, guys, 17th of April, and we have another update relating to our current issue. But first, as always, I'll remind people, we'd really appreciate your support if you go to extratimemovie.com. That's extratimemovie.com. And stream or download our new movie with Donal O'Neill from Serial Killers, and I'm in it too. And we scan and track 45 middle-aged sporting heroes, and we find out a lot of fascinating stuff around heart disease, and we intervene with very clever interventions and stop and maybe even reverse heart disease progression. So great if you can support us on that one, share as much as you can. So Dr. Asim Malhotra, cardiologist from UK, has a new paper out, and it talks all around what we've talked about before a little, and that's around dietary impacts on your immune health, your metabolic health, and how that might greatly affect if you're likely to have a serious outcome or not from the current situation. So great to see you again, Sim.
Always good to see you, mate.
Yeah, and you're just published in the European Journal literally yesterday or today, I think.
Yeah, it was just published online last night. And basically, the it's COVID-19, the elephant in the room. And it's about the fact that really what we should be promoting in terms of public health messaging is eat real food to protect the NHS and save lives. And I think the we'll talk about the science behind that in a minute, but I think it's something that's really missing from the discussion. In fact, I would say, given the evidence that's there, it's actually negligent of public health officials, of government, to not give very clear advice that changing diet, making sure you're eating the right foods, is crucial to reducing illness and mortality rates from COVID-19.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And I had interviews with Dr. Ron Rosedale and Dr. Paul Mason in Australia and Dr. Steve Horvitz. All the same, the science, the mechanisms, everything lines up. This COVID situation, there's a 10 times or more risk for having poor metabolic health, possibly much more. And you can change your metabolism and get back metabolic health, we know, very quickly if you do the right thing. So yeah, we'll talk about what the right thing is.
Yeah, absolutely, Ivor. I couldn't agree more. And in fact, that's what I, I practice what I preach myself, but actually more importantly, my patients are reversing their metabolic syndrome within 21 days of a specific plan that I give them, which is based around low carb. And we can talk about that. So we know that works with patients. We know there's good, reasonably good data that's published out there that shows this is also very effective in terms of dietary interventions. So it needs to be part of the mainstream discussion. Unfortunately, it's not getting it so far, hasn't had that much in the mainstream media. Other than maybe, there was obviously my interview a few weeks ago that you helpfully put out on your social media around my Sky News discussion on metabolic syndrome. But I think the evidence has accumulated even more since then that having chronic metabolic disease is a major risk for mortality. And I think what's more disturbing is that, only 1 in 8 people in the United States are actually metabolically healthy, which suggests 7 out of 8 are at risk. Now, of course, it's going to be to differing degrees depending on how many risk factors you have. But this also, Ivor, applies to people who are not overweight or are not obese. In fact, the evidence suggests from the US that in people over the age of 20, in adults basically, less than 1 in 3 with a normal BMI are actually metabolically healthy in terms of optimal metabolic health. So, I've said this before and I'll say it again. There's no such thing as a healthy weight, only a healthy person. So getting the right kind of foods in and the right diet is actually a message for everybody, not just people who are overweight or obese.
Yeah, well said, Asim. And just other figures from America, I like quoting because we have the best data from there. 64% of over 45s are now officially pre-diabetic or diabetic in the figures. And that means if you used insulin and better measures, could be 75-80%. And exactly as you say, they are not all obese or very overweight. There's a huge proportion that are diabetic, but without the obesity, or the TOFIs are in their millions, tens of millions. So that's a crucial point for people to understand. If you see someone who doesn't appear obese, who has a heart attack or has problems with this issue, you know, don't look at the fat, the body fat. It could be healthy body fat if you're lucky, or you could be not fat, not obese, and have massive liver fat and diabetic dysfunction. So you need the bloods to see.
Absolutely, Ivor. And I think, you know, on that note, one thing I wrote about in my article in European Scientist, which people can go and read, and it's well referenced, is that there's been a lot of discussion, as you've probably been aware of, in the US and in the UK, that there seems to be a disproportionate mortality rate, higher mortality rate, disproportionate effect on people from Black and Asian and ethnic minority backgrounds. And again, when I saw that data straight away, I knew this is going to be linked to chronic metabolic disease. So we know that metabolic syndrome, which we'll define in a second, is associated with a tenfold increase in mortality. But amongst the South Asian community, for example, in Britain, and amongst Black, Afro-Caribbeans, the prevalence of type 2 diabetes, which is part of metabolic syndrome, as you know, is 3 to 5 times more common than people who are, you know, Caucasian. So think about that. So a lot of these people, again, and those are the people that are going to be often not the so-called overtly obese patients. They're going to be people that have, you know, that toffee, as you talk about, the thin on the outside, fat on the inside. So I think on that, what would be useful, I think, for people listening and watching, Ivor, is let's just try and help people understand the definition of optimal metabolic health. So there are 5 factors. Updated guidelines suggest that, one, you want your, and this is obviously not being on medication, you want your blood pressure systolic to be less than 120, your diastolic less than 80 millimeters of mercury. Triglycerides should be ideally less than 1.7 milligrams per deciliter, and your HDL should be greater than one, sorry, millimoles per liter, greater than one. So triglycerides should be less than 1.7, HDL greater than one. Waist circumference for men should be less than 102 centimeters, and for women less than 88 centimeters. And in terms of HbA1c, basically you don't want to be pre-diabetic. So your HbA1c should be less than 5.7%. And these are the crucial facts people need to understand. And if they're in those categories, then they have optimal metabolic health. But as we've already talked about, less than 1 in 8 adults in the United States are metabolically healthy. And more specifically, this affects young people too. So I looked at that data again to look at different age groups. Between the ages of 20 and 40, only 25% of people are metabolically healthy, which says 75% of adults in the United States between the ages of 20 and 40 are metabolically healthy. That is very, very disturbing.
Yeah, absolutely the same. And I know that definition is that I think having no bad markers, so it's a pretty tight definition. But at the same time, the definition in another way is a little loose. Like I would say, rather than below 1.7, you should be below 1.2 in triglycerides, or below 100 in milligrams per deciliter. And HDL, rather than men being above 40, you should probably be thinking of being above 60 milligrams or above 1.3 rather than just above 1.
Sure. So, yeah. I think I'd be absolutely. You can even optimize that further, as you know. And of course, with people with heart disease, the triglyceride to HDL ratio ideally should be less than 1, to get the optimal chances in terms of reducing progression of heart disease in relation to a topic we know very well, which is insulin resistance, which is really at the root of this problem. And I think one of the things that's being missed from this discussion, again, is, you know, that the conventional medical approach is you treat individual risk factors with drugs, as opposed to trying to target many risk factors with lifestyle, you know, and with getting those dietary changes right. And those dietary changes, Ivor, with the evidence we have, and of course there are limitations in nutritional science, we don't have as many randomized controlled trials as you get, for example, with drug trials. But with the data we have, and with our clinical experience, those metabolic markers improve within a few weeks from, you know, I recommend cutting out the refined carbs and sugar and getting, you know, the best of the components of the Mediterranean diet, which is a mixture of vegetables, you know, non-starchy vegetables, oily fish, olive oil, nuts, seeds, you know, plenty of good protein sources from meat, eggs, etc. And if you're a vegetarian, you can still do it, but you know, you need to be eating pulses and making sure you're still cutting out the starch and the sugar. Combine that with moderate activity, you know, 30 minutes of moderate activity a day, which a lot of people are hopefully doing in lockdown. And then thinking about other aspects as well, which I see in my patients, which sometimes gets ignored, which is, you know, dealing with stress, doing whatever you can to reduce the stress levels, and making sure you're getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. So if, you know, those may be seen as pie in the sky, but if people try and target all of those things together, they can get themselves in a much better state. And in the article in European Scientists, I also mentioned the fact that on a population level, if we get this right, and I would then say we target the low-hanging fruit of ultra-processed food, which is unfortunately now more than half of the British diet, it's 72% of food that's purchased in hospitals either. You know, and one of the reasons this discussion isn't getting as much airing as it is, and I think it's partly embarrassment from the medical profession. You know, more than 50% of NHS employees are overweight or obese. That's putting them at increased risk as well. And I think that's missing from the discussion because of part of that is embarrassment. Some of it is ignorance as well, that they are themselves at risk. We're all at risk of this diet-related disease and risk of COVID-19 mortality. So we need to bring that to the forefront as doctors and say, listen, you know, this is something that's affecting everybody. And linked to that is we've got to also ask ourselves this question. I know you've been posting a lot of things on social media about what is this lockdown? Who is it for? How long does it last for? Is it causing more harm to population health than good? But the main reason that we have this lockdown, which has been made very clear, is to protect the NHS from being overwhelmed. But the reason we're doing that is because our health systems, our NHS, were already overstretched to begin with, either because we've not dealt with the root cause of this being overstretched, which is diet-related disease and obesity. And if, you know, as I've concluded in my article, and people can read it and draw their own conclusions, what we need to do now is really get government to say, listen, we need policy changes. We need dietary advice to be updated. We need the food environment to be made healthier so people can make healthy choices, you know, and that may also involve making healthier food more affordable and junk food, you know, more expensive. Is if we get population health healthier, we'd have a more manageable health service. And if and when the next viral pandemic happens, another type of coronavirus in the next decade, which is highly likely to happen, we may not need lockdown because we've got a healthier population, we've got reduced mortality and a more manageable health service that can handle that increase in death rates, you know, which does not get to the level it is at the moment. So we have to think about the future too. And unless we do that, we are going to be in a much more difficult position the next time this happens.
Yeah, well, a lot to unpack there, Asim, but agree totally. And just one thing I'll say before I reply there. So people hear about type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and you went through the five criteria. But I'm going to say something now that might help people. So insulin resistance syndrome, hyperinsulinemia syndrome, leptin resistance syndrome, right? Metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, etc., etc. They're all the same thing to the lay person. You don't need to worry. All those terms are the same physiological dysfunction. And yes, it's overwhelmingly driven by ultra-processed foods, sugar, refined grains, and seed oils. So it's actually a simple enough thing. And like you say, and I always say the same thing, if everyone switched to meat, fish, eggs, avocado, you know, non-starchy vegetables, just real food, you're going to get a massive bang for the buck. And just an anecdote that's actually not an anecdote. I met a guy in Denver last month, a doctor called Raj, Asian extraction. He was quite overweight, but he had dropped his weight massively around 6 months ago. And he said, Ivor, thank you for your material. I discovered it, made sense. And you know how quickly I reversed my diabetes or put it in remission. And I said, well, Raj, you're going to say now it should be a month or two, but you're probably going to say a few weeks. And he said, Ivor, 10 days. I tested myself 10 days after a knife-edge switch to real food like we're talking about. 10 days later, my blood glucose was down and my insulin was rocketing down. So people need to realize that enormous fact. There's a massive increase in risk because your innate immune system that's overreacting with this problem is also called your metabolic immune system, right? It's intimately connected. And you can't have a proper immune system when you've got diabetic dysfunction. And you can address that. We know in principle, literally within days and a week or two, you're going to be enhancing your health and your resilience. So this is such an important message.
Absolutely, Ivor. And in fact, even just reminds me, there was a study that I'd referenced in a paper I'd done with Robert Lustig. It was research that Robert Lustig, professor of pediatric endocrinology in California, had done. And it was actually just showing within 9 days in obese children, he was able to improve significantly their metabolic markers just from cutting sugar. But, you know, this is even without changing the cutting the starch, just exchanging, just getting rid of sugar and exchanging it for starch, interesting, which we know is also a problem. But just from cutting out sugar, these kids were able to improve their metabolic function in 9 days. So yes, absolutely. This is completely scientific. It's conceivable. Of course, there's going to be inter-individual variation, as we know. You know, data from Verta, from diabetes.co.uk, which I've, again, I've kind of referenced in my piece, shows that, you know, 25% to 50% of patients will send their type 2 into remission. And that usually happens, actually. Their data is up to a year and 2 years. But the initial massive drop in HbA1c happens within a couple of months. So I think people need to realize that, yes, you'll get the biggest impact in terms of glucose within a couple of months. But again, what I would add as well is that we shouldn't also just be completely reductionist on this, because as we know, there are multiple risk factors. Insulin resistance is probably the most important. Is we also think about other things as well. You know, what kind of foods are you eating that are going to be anti-inflammatory? Chronic inflammation is at the heart of this problem too. And, you know, it does mean that you should think about getting those foods that are going to be anti-inflammatory. And that does mean getting your omega-3s in there. It does mean a variety of vegetables. You know, I think people need to also think, is it just about body fat? It's about chronic inflammation as well.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because we always emphasize the insulin resistance axis because, well, Pareto principle, the 20% of stuff you target, that'll give you 80% of the bang for the buck. But you're absolutely right. And also things like smoking, obviously, enormous oxidative stress, and exercise gives you huge advantages in health, not so much in weight loss. And also maybe people need to worry about a little. Some people are sensitive to certain foods and they get an autoimmune type reaction. And that's very damaging to the vasculature and to the whole system. So some people need to be careful to take certain foods and lectins and certain problematic things out of their diet. But we won't get into that here. It's a bit detailed.
Yeah, absolutely, Ivor. I think, that's just that kind of that whole food approach, I still think, is probably a helpful message on a population level. Of course, individuals are going to need some changes specifically to certain foods. But, you know, I think one of the things that people get a bit confused about or want to know more about is, how do you define ultra-processed food? And what I tell my patients is, really, if it comes out of a packet, you know, it's mass-produced and it has preservative additives, and most often it has five or more ingredients. So if you look up the list and it'll have these unhealthy seed oils you've talked about, starch and sugars, then it's ultra-processed and it's best avoided. And you want to switch to whole foods and minimally processed foods. And of course, for people that can't necessarily afford, you know, having and probably aren't even don't even have the skills anymore to cook from scratch, you know, a lot of tinned food is still a much, much, much better option, whether it's tinned tuna or some tinned vegetables. So you can still do that relatively cheaply, and it will still impact massively on your health.
Yeah, great point. And, you know, things like eggs are still relatively inexpensive for superfoods with protein, fats, and super healthy. Organ meats are super cheap. And you know what? That's a great one. The packet foods, there's a small minority of packet foods that are actually not that bad. But like you say, if they're not stuffed with sugar, refined grains, and seed oils, they might be okay, but you need to get to be a label reader. But Tesco, I noticed as well, has ready meals in our local Tesco. And when you look in the back, it's pretty much just real food in them, you know, and they're very cheap. I looked up the energy and the nutrient level. You know, they're putting meat and vegetables and maybe a bit of potato into a tray. Very cheap, considering that it's real food and it's so convenient. So, you know, there are products out there that, that work.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. I think, people need to just think about what they're putting in their mouth. And you know, I think the other thing to mention in terms of why ultra-processed food's bad in particular, you know, they're high in the sort of refined starch, but they lack those micronutrients, vitamins, and they lack the fiber of whole foods as well. I know there's a different debate about fiber going on, but certainly we know with whole foods, fiber does reduce the absorption of glucose and therefore attenuates the insulin response.
Yeah, and I think if you are eating a kind of carb-heavy diet, or a diet that's not ideal, having fiber and whole food types in it will help attenuate. Exactly. If you're just eating the optimum meat, fish, eggs and vegetables, maybe you don't need to worry as much, but it's a good point to throw in there. So we wanted to keep this really tight. If there's anything else you want to add, Asim, and also, can I attach the paper to this post?
Yeah, absolutely. Please do, Ivor. Wow. Yeah, it's open access. So, I'd be delighted if you attach it, because people can, you know, it's getting a lot of good traction and feedback. And I think it's one of those ones that people in the scientific community can read, but also, you know, members of the lay public can probably understand as well. And, you know, it gives a kind of, you know, I do give advice specifically with references in terms of what people could and should be doing.
Excellent. And I read it last night, and exactly as you say, it's excellent. Lay people, no problemo. So if everyone out there could get out, get the link and share the paper, not just read it. I mean, that's the thing, share it. And I will also mention again, extratimemovie.com. Don't just watch it and enjoy it and get all the learnings from it, but ideally help us to share it. It'll really support us. So thanks a lot, Asim, and we'll circle back again maybe next week for a latest update.
Absolutely, mate. Really good to speak to you, Ivor. Keep up the great work.
Yourself too. Great stuff. Bye.
Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see my subscribe button in the middle of the screen, and go to extratimemovie.com to see our fascinating new documentary on stopping and reversing heart disease.